Sorry, the church I pastor in Italy on a slow Sunday has about 25 people in it, and on a busy day has about 50 people in it, and I just don't need the mic. I actually don't need the mic, but you don't want to hear that. My wife always tells me, you know, she and I used to do a lot of singing, but I never knew how to modulate my voice. So I only have two voices, the one you can't hear and the one you don't want to hear. But if you have your Bible, go ahead and open it to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 47. That's our text for this morning, verses 1 to 12. You'll want to keep it open. It's not a text that I find a lot of evangelicals actually know. And I know many pastors that have died the death of 1,000 resolutions because they all planned on preaching it, never got around to it. But we're going to look at that this morning. Before we do that, I just want to tell you something. Back in 2010, I took a trip to see my doctor. And I went there with a specific complaint. My complaint was I was having trouble walking. Both feet were failing me, and it was my mom's fault because she was born without arches, and so was I. So people were always wondering, how did I ever retire from the military with feet with no arches? But somehow I managed to get through it. But as I got older, things got worse, and it became hard to walk. So I went to the doc, and he sent me to a orthopedic surgeon. So he stared at my feet for a minute, and I said, "Doc, what are my options?" And he said, "Well, we can put you in braces, and you'll walk in those clunky braces for the rest of your life." Well, that didn't sound like a good option, so that brought me to option number two. He said, "We're going to break your feet. We're going to break both of your feet. We're going to fuse the bones together. Then we're going to put pins and screws in there. But the chances are good that the operation will be a success." And I thought about it. I said, "Are you telling me that you have to break my feet so that I can keep on walking?" He said, "Exactly." Well, that's an interesting lesson, because that's what the Word of God does too, if you think about it. I mean, we do like to read the Bible as a book of comfort to us, encouragement, and it certainly is that. Sometimes we don't like to think about it, but the Bible is also there to break us so that we can walk with Jesus. So the messages there in the Bible are not always affirming. They're not always encouraging messages. They're always true. And they're always given to us by a loving God who needs us to have our feet broken so we can walk with Him also. As we look at this text, I want you to think about that. The Israelites, who are the target of this passage from the prophet Ezekiel, are people that have problems. You know, they're in exile, away from their homes, but they created their own problems. They were sinners. They were disobedient to God. So God sent them a message to help them to see. Now we'll read it, and then I'll describe how He does this. Starting in verse 1, and I want you to get this. This is a vision, like a lot of Ezekiel are overlapping visions. They're strange. But if you understand the content of the vision, you'll see how it applies to us. It's not that difficult. Starting verse 1. "Then he led me back to the door of the temple, and behold, water was issuing from below the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. The water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple south of the altar." So that's kind of one picture. Verse 2, "Then he brought me out by the way of the north gate, led me around to the outside, to the outer gate that faces towards the east." Don't get bogged down. "And behold, the water was trickling out on the south side. Going on eastward with a measuring line in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits, which I guess about 1,500 feet, and then led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. Okay? Started as a trickle, now it's ankle deep. Verse 4, again he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again he measured 1,000, led me through the water, it was not waist deep. Again he measured 1,000, and it was a river I could not pass through, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be passed through. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen this? As I went back, I saw on the bank of the river very many trees on one side and the other, and he said to me, This water flows towards the east region and goes down into the Arabah and enters the sea. Where the water flows into sea, the water will become fresh. And wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish. For this water goes there, that the waters of the sea may become fresh, so everything will live where the river goes. By the way, the sea is the Dead Sea. Okay? We'll get back to that. Fishermen will stand by beside the sea from En-Gedi to En-Gliyim. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the great sea. But its swamps and marshes will not become fresh, for they're left for salt. And on the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. You know, on the surface of it, you get this sort of mysterious picture of water and rivers and fish and trees and stuff, and you're trying to figure out what all of that means. Probably the way you feel about it, and the way I did when I first read it, is I say, well, that's good. There are some good things that are happening in this picture, even if I don't completely understand what they are. But to think that way is also to miss the point here that Ezekiel makes when he's writing this whole book. Ezekiel is a book in which God laughs at his people all of the time. He actually ridicules the people. I mean, it's kind of like parents that look at their kids doing something dumb, and he laughs at them because their efforts are so dumb. And then he reminds them that he loves them. That their futures don't depend on their decisions, but they depend on God's love and his goodness. That's the backdrop of Ezekiel. He's actually talking to a stubborn, rebellious people who don't want to listen to anybody. And he tells them through a whole series of pictures that not only are they dumb, but he's not. And not only are they selfish, but he's not. And not only are they impotent, but he's not. So in that way, it's a book of criticism on one side and promise on the other. That's important because, you know, I find myself reading this and thinking about the state of the church. And, you know, you get a chance to do that when you live overseas and then you travel a lot and you work in Asia, Europe, and America in different ways. I wonder if God doesn't laugh at our churches. I think God has a sense of humor. I mean, he made us after all. But I wonder if he laughs. What do you think? I mean, I sort of think he does. What does he laugh at? Well, just like the Israelites, I think he laughs at our attempts at self-importance. Maybe more significantly, he laughs at our attempt as a church to be constantly relevant to the culture around us. Not that relevance is bad. I mean, to be relevant is a good thing, means you're communicating. But if you chase relevance, then it gets comical after a while. The harder we try to be relevant, did you notice that? The harder we're trying as Christians to be relevant in our culture, the more irrelevant we're becoming. It would be hard to escape the fact that Christian church is more marginalized now than it has ever been in the history of our country. And there's no reason to believe that that trend will change anytime soon. It's a reality. We try harder and we get less for it. Maybe that's because it's about us. Now, what Ezekiel does with the Israelites, I think God has for us to hear. What Ezekiel's going to do is he's going to share four truths with his people that we need to take note of because they address us too. Okay, four truths. The first is that our God is an incomprehensible God. We're going to talk about that briefly. Second, God's methods are incomprehensible. Third, God's salvation is incomprehensible. And finally, engaging in mission or the ministry of the church is trusting in an incomprehensible God. So that incomprehensible thing needs to be right at the forefront of our thinking this morning. Let me get to it. Our God is an incomprehensible God. Now, I didn't say that God is an unknowable God. You didn't hear me say that. We know that God is knowable because he makes himself known to us. I mean, the one thing we say is you can't get to God on your own. God reveals himself to his people. True? He tells us who he is. He tells us who we are, and he brings us into a relationship with us, with him. But he is incomprehensible because you can't peel back the surface of God and see what's inside. You can't look at the essence of God. It's not what we do. So no matter how hard we try to understand the deepest things of God, we can only go so far. It's a limitation. We were created people after all. We weren't made gods. So we can't understand God the way God understands God. It's just not possible. Now, God demonstrates that he's incomprehensible in his word. One of the things he does, of course, is he keeps revealing himself as a God of surprises. In fact, in the Old Testament, the only people that had God nailed down were false prophets. But if you believed in the true God, if you were a follower of the true God, that was the God of the whirlwind. That was the God that emerged when you least thought you'd see him. That he would work in ways that you could never see coming. You couldn't anticipate them. It's not like Severus Snape in the Harry Potter stuff, what did he say? He could bottle death? You could put a stopper in death, that's what he said. Right? Like you can control these things? But God is God. We don't control God. When my daughter Elizabeth died many, many years ago in 2004, people gave me a lot of books to try and help me with our grief. And it wasn't unexpected. It was a long-term problem. The only book that meant anything to me, I found myself, and it was an ancient book, John Chrysostom's The Incomprehensibility of God. I read that and I was instantly comforted. The idea that I don't actually know what God is up to sometimes, it became a comfort to me. Like, sometimes that unsettles us because we actually want to know and want to plan. We want everything worked out. But God doesn't always conform to our wishes in that regard. He's incomprehensible. Second of all, he's incomprehensible because our own understanding of God is limited. In the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel uses two words a lot. The word is like and likeness. And he uses those words because they're approximations. God is like this. You can have an analog to God, but you can't have an exact picture of God. In fact, there is only one in the Bible, and his name is Jesus. That's it. So our knowledge of God is limited. And then thirdly, God is incomprehensible because our creatureliness and our sinfulness just get in the way of knowing him, right? So we get in our own way. Ezekiel actually says that earlier in his book. He says this in chapter 3, "But the house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you." So God is speaking to the prophet. "For they are not willing to listen to me." So God is saying they're not going to listen to me either. Because, and here's the part, I mean, you hate hearing it, but I love the way he says it, because it applies perfectly to moi. "Because all the house of Israel have a hard forehead and a stubborn heart." It's perfect. It's perfect. Hard forehead? Yeah, absolutely right. You know, so whenever I have a plan out there, I'm going to fight to the death to make sure my plan works, even if it's the dumbest possible thing I could do. And if God has already demonstrated in 100 ways why it's not actually going to work, I'm going to stick with it until it just runs out of gas and I have to give up. So God is incomprehensible. It is a fact. Second, God's methods are incomprehensible. Let me backtrack for a second. Maybe you don't know why I'm doing this. I live and work in mission field for a long time. One of the things that I notice about we missionaries, is it us or we? Come on, y'all are homeschoolers. Is it us or we? Us. One thing I know about us missionaries is that we're really good at planning strategies out, putting together a plan, implementing the plan, and then checking in with God later, just because we get slightly nervous about what we're doing. It's what we do. We go all over the world, and people applaud our going because we're following God, except sometimes we're actually not following God that much. We're following the plan. What this passage is here to do is to straighten out our thinking so that we start from the right point. We don't start with our plan and work back to God. We actually start with God and who He is, and then we go from there. Now, does that make sense? So, God's methods are incomprehensible. So not only is He in His person incomprehensible, but His ways, His methods are incomprehensible. In verses 1 to 6, you see this at play. In the first thing, that the act of God, where we get this image of water that begins to trickle down out of the temple and going downhill and then all sorts of other places, what Ezekiel describes there in verses 1 to 6 look insignificant. How important is a dribble of water? It's not very dramatic, is it? It's something really small that doesn't seem important. Second, it seems to grow, but there doesn't seem to be any natural cause to it. That's really important in our text. How does it trickle like a leak? Go backwards again. The temple. You go in the temple, there's only one source of water, and that's a bowl of water that priests use for purification. Okay? A bowl. No, I don't see any. But like when we baptize our kids sometimes, we open that thing up, we dip a little water out, we pour it or sprinkle it, correct? Well, the priests were doing the same kind of thing in the temple. How much water is that? A quart? Gallon? I don't know. You know, 2 liters? But here in the book of Ezekiel, you have that little dribbling that seems to come from the temple. Only one source. And then it turns into a mighty river. Where did all the other water come from? Isn't it kind of... Look at your text. Do you see it in there? Are there other tributaries that feed that little trickle? How about no? Right? No, there aren't. It has no external source, but it seems to grow unnaturally. In the natural world, you just don't get rivers from dribbles. It just doesn't happen. Something has to feed the growth. But in the case of Ezekiel, there is nothing to feed it. It just grows on its own, and there is no explanation given, and there's a lesson in that. So it has no natural cause. Third, it follows an unpredictable route. Now, if you took out your map and you just looked at this whole thing and the ups and downs, ins and outs of the text, let me just cut to the chase. In order to get to the Dead Sea, the water that starts as a dribble in the temple actually has to go uphill and around hills on its own. It has to go up and over the Mount of Olives on its own. You know a lot of rivers that go uphill like that? I don't. You see the point? It's inexplicable. It's incomprehensible. How can it possibly happen? So you and I, as natural human beings, we just look at things, and all the answers we have in life exist in the created universe, just like we do. So when we try to explain phenomena, we go into the world we live in order to understand them. But what Ezekiel is saying to the Israelites here is you cannot understand God in himself, nor can you understand anything he does naturally. You cannot. Third, his salvation, therefore, if his actions are incomprehensible, so is his salvation. His salvation is incomprehensible. Listen to what he does between verses 7 and 12. It's amazing. You can summarize it and say that in this picture, what God does is he brings a dead world back to life. Pretty phenomenal. Living water brings fish to life. Where? In the Dead Sea. I mean, it's so loaded with salt and minerals, people can float on it almost endlessly without sinking. Nothing lives there. Everything is dead, hence the name. It's the Dead Sea. Are you going to, like, open a fishing industry in the Dead Sea? I'm not, right? I'm not an economist, but I'm not all that stupid either. But here, God actually takes the deadest thing you can imagine, and he brings life to it. Isn't that incredible? So he brings... he brings life. He brings these fish to life in the Dead Sea. In verse 11, it says he doesn't screw around. He doesn't mess with the salt. That's true. And people then wonder if he's on a rabbit trail. I don't think so. I think what Ezekiel is saying in these verses is that everything broken, everything shattered by the fall, everything destroyed by human sin is put right. The Israelite, the Jews, Hebrew has the word for that, shalom. Shalom doesn't just mean peace. You know, I grew up in a kind of part Italian, part Jewish neighborhood. People would say shalom, and, you know, they meant hi. Right? And literally you could say it means peace, but it means way, 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 way more than that. What shalom actually means is everything is cool. Everything that got messed up, everything that just doesn't feel right, like you're a musician, dissonance. There is no unwelcome dissonance, the sound that shouldn't be there. Everything is as it should be. It's all put right. I mean, if you read the Chronicles of Narnia, that's one of the things Lewis does in there also. He talks about everything being messed up, realigned. We mentioned in Sunday school, so just so you know that your kids are getting the highest possible Sunday school education, we talked about the early church father Irenaeus recapitulating creation. He not only brings it back to life, but he realigns it and he perfects it. He finishes everything he starts so that it comes out not back to where the garden was when Adam and Eve were placed in it, but where it was supposed to go in the first place. That's what this prophecy, that's what this image is pointing towards. Incomprehensibly, though, in a way you can't engineer it. You can't hijack the process. You can't co-opt it. You can't speak into it and say, can we modify this incomprehensible? No. There is something you can do, but you can't do that. Fruit trees line the shore. You get the perfect picture of sustainable life, perpetuated life in the picture. Well, what's it doing? Well, we can cut to the chase. Ezekiel here, like he is elsewhere, and I'm going to be preaching from him next week on Palm Sunday. This is a great text. What he does is he's looking forward to Christ, of course, who makes all things new, who sits on his throne, and as he does, then we get this emerging picture in the book of Revelation of a perfected garden, of where the garden would have gone if we had messed it all up ourselves. It becomes a perfect place. If you want a picture of it, go and Google this after church. And I'm serious. Go to, write these words down. Adoration of the Mystic Lamb. Go ahead and do that. Trust me. The Adoration of the Mystic Lamb is an altarpiece that's in Ghent, Belgium. It was painted by two brothers, the Van Eyck brothers, in probably around the 1420s. To see it's breathtaking because it's really huge. It's most of the size of this wall, and it's on two sides, it's on back and front. The most important part of it is in the middle. And what you have a picture of is you have a Father, a Holy Spirit, and Son. The Son is a lamb, and the lamb has a hole in his side, and there's water and blood pouring out of it into a cup, and from the cup it goes down into a river of life. And then on the flanks of the picture, the upper right, upper left, right, bottom left, right, are all the people in the world. So peasants, rich people, powerful people, powerless people, religious orders, all of them are all watered from that side, the fountain of life. What Ezekiel is obviously pointing our attention to is that, like in the Old Testament, when Moses struck the rock and water poured out of it, that was just looking forward to a gusher of water greater than anyone could have predicted that would flood the deserts and bring life back to it. That's the picture we have of God's incomprehensible salvation. That's what he is doing. I think about it often. You know, I just came back from Bangladesh 2 months ago. We had a meeting in Moody, Alabama about how the work is going. And I was thinking about this. Back in 2013, a couple of Southern Baptists put out a survey. And what they were doing was they were looking at conversion rates around the world. Now, I'm a Presbyterian, so we always suspect numbers, right? Probably wisely. But I thought the report was fascinating. What it did was it listed the 20 fastest growing conversion rates in the world, country by country. How many of those were in the West? Want to guess? We can do this interactive for a moment. No, there were none. Out of the top 20, 11 out of the top 20 are in Muslim countries. Want to hear that again? I do. I'm going to say it again. It feels good to me. 11 out of the top 20 are in Muslim countries. The number one was not. It was Nepal, what is Nepal? Buddhist, I think. Number two was China. And then from three all the way down, most of the rest are actually Muslim countries. I call that incomprehensible, don't you? We watch the news, we listen to things. We also listen to missionaries, we hear their stories, and it doesn't add up to this. It just doesn't. You know, I'm a really good strategic planner, I'm an analyst. I can't figure this out. I know that if I visit friends that work in the Persian Gulf, if they can get me in to see them, I can visit meetings of Christians. They see themselves as Christians. They believe they're Christians. They have churches, sometimes underground, because they're not allowed to have churches, like in Saudi Arabia. But they're coming to Christ a lot. The fastest conversion rates in Europe are not Europeans. They're actually those refugees that are moving over. Years ago, I met a French pastor who was depressed, like most French pastors are. Well, nothing against French pastors. The French intellectuals are also always depressed. So you knew you were French intellectual because you smoked cigarettes and you were depressed. He just said he was frustrated because the French weren't coming to Christ. So I probed it more. And he finally said there was a church of Cameroonians, so Africans, in North Paris, and they were really growing, and they were coming to the Lord. And I said, well, what does it do for your theory? And he said, well, okay, that is an exception. Now, let me ask you another question. Are the people, those Cameroonians, reaching only Cameroonians? He said, at the beginning they were. Well, how about now? And he said, no, they're reaching the French. And I said, you told me nobody was. Made him think, too. So God's doing incomprehensible things in our presence, and they're really quite wonderful. Okay, last thing, last point, something to leave us all with. So God's salvation is incomprehensible. The way he works is incomprehensible. He is, in his nature, incomprehensible. But there's a however then. However, so what does that mean to me? What am I supposed to do? If God is incomprehensible, where does that leave me? Where does it leave you? Where does it leave your church? Because you have to figure out, okay, we exist to follow Jesus in this world. We do it locally. We do it internationally. So then how do we do that if God's incomprehensible? My statement, my thought on this is that mission is an act of trust. Full, as the Brits say, full stop. To engage in God's mission anywhere is first and foremost an act of trust. The reason I say that is because if you can't understand it, you still follow it. You still follow God even if you don't understand everything he's up to. You follow God even if you can't predict where he's going to go. You follow God even though when you add up all the resources you have, you still come up short. But it requires you to trust. You see where I'm going with this? Having said that then, the mission of the church starts on its knees. It starts out with our relationship to the Lord. It doesn't start with action. It doesn't start with plans. It doesn't start with recruitment or marketing or any of that other stuff. It starts on our knees in the presence of God, asking him for his direction to us, which God is more than glad to supply because he speaks to us all of the time. He does it in his word. God is always speaking to us. He just needs us to stop talking and start listening to what he says. Now, this is not a platitude. I'm saying this on the basis of bitter experience, that we need to actually stop and listen to God. We need to be a humble people that rely on God for his direction in our church and in the work that we engage in. We need to be a humble people. If we do that, if we learn how to listen to God, even though he's incomprehensible, even though we don't always know exactly where it's going to end up, it does things to change us. When we do that, when we start out with trust, when trust becomes the premier value of our engagement in God's mission. We trust that most important thing. We become what Oz Guinness recently called, if you haven't read this thing, it's great, impossible people. Oz Guinness, in his book Impossible People, basically says that Christians in the West have two choices, irrelevance or impossibility. You either become irrelevant people or you become impossible people. Impossible people, he calls them that because when the church was really young in the Roman Empire, Romans thought Christians were impossible because the Romans were trying to be reasonable. They were just saying, if you just make some compromises, you can go ahead and do all the worship you want. Nobody wants to kill you. It's too much trouble, right? I mean, think of all the manpowers that it would take to kill you. So what Oz Guinness does is he says, just as the early church proved to be impossible in the eyes of the Romans, so Christians need to be impossible today. We become impossible when we just trust God, because that's incomprehensible to the world. So we end up doing things. We end up embracing things. We end up proclaiming things that are impossible to the world, but they're true. And we do it without reservation. We have no conditions on it. If we do that, we become impossible people. And another guy, Rodney Stark, if you haven't read him, he's got a book on the rise of Christianity. It's very good reading. He says that the early church succeeded in the face of opposition because it developed invincible obstinacy. Y'all are reasonable people. Could you be impossible people? What do you think? It's a good question, isn't it? But if we follow an incomprehensible God in the world, which thinks God is so completely nonsense, then we become impossible people. And if we stick with it long enough, we will see God working through all of that. Last point, see what God is doing through faithful Christians and go with them. That's also part of this incomprehensibility. We're control people. We like doing what we're good at doing. You all have ministries, you all have preferences, you do things that you like doing, you're comfortable doing them, you want to do them, they make you feel good when you do them, they're useful. But let's just say this. What God may have in store for you, though, is something else entirely. It's out way beyond your comfort zone. It's not something you even want to think about. You speak from personal experience. You end up being pulled into a life that you could never have seen coming. But the only thing that matters at all in that life is that you follow Jesus in it. He will not always lead you to be a reasonable person or go into reasonable places that require nothing more than your own resources you already have. God is really unreasonable, and he actually wants us to be impossible people who just trust him. Amen?